And welcome everyone to another episode of All Things Trek. I'm Oren.
I'm Grace.
I am the Klingon. Wait, I am David.
And both of those things are accurate.
Yeah, they're both things we call you.
Every now and then I just flash back to the old action figures and it said Gowron, the Klingon.
The
as
Klingon.
We would forgot, yeah.
Not a Klingon, mind you, but the Klingon.
He is like the epitomal Klingon, I guess.
I don't think he is. I'm not convinced. Martok, maybe.
Yeah, I'd probably go with Martok, too, personally, but...
You know, if I'm picking favorite Klingons here, it's always going to be Martok. I mean, I like Worf. Worf's a cool guy, but it's always going to be Martok. Martok is the best Klingon.
But Worf plays baseball!
It's true, but I'm pretty convinced that Gowron, Martok, will be pretty awesome at baseball.
Death to the opposition.
I think this is a thing. Although he does only have one eye, I'm not really sure how much that affects baseball playing.
It would. Depth perception would be kind of weird.
Like, I would imagine it would be hard to know exactly when to swing the bat if you had bad depth perception.
Maybe he could coach. Maybe he could coach or be shortstop.
He could be, I don't know, I guess there's no full contact in baseball.
Not unless you want to get out.
Well, is it worth it? I mean, like, sometimes when you're playing sports, it's worth it to get a foul to stop your opponent from doing something.
Yeah, can you guys tell that I watched Take Me Out to the Hollow Suite last night?
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
Oh, that's a good
episode. On the brain.
That's a really good episode.
Yeah, it was...
I'm not a huge... Sorry, go ahead, Dave.
It was adorable.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really like baseball. I have, you know, never voluntarily watched a baseball game.
What?
But I love that episode. It's a really good episode. Because it's got, like, it uses baseball very effectively as to work out some of the issues that Sisko is having, and to also help put a little bit of lightheartedness into this super heavy Cold War arc, Dominion War arc that we had going on.
Yeah.
Such a good episode.
I've said it before and I'll say it again. There's a special kind of magic to Star Trek filler episodes.
There is, and they can be really, really bad, but they can also be very good.
Yeah.
And I mean, I guess I would ask, is it really filler? Because it serves an important purpose.
I don't know. I think that's like another conversation for another time.
I guess that depends on what we define as filler.
Yeah.
Also, I just love how, I love that they lose at the end, and that's okay.
Yeah.
It's like so many sports movies, it's kind of like, no, going home with second place is tantamount to failure. We must win at all costs. And it's like...
Well, I mean, they were Vulcans. I mean, yeah.
Douchey Vulcans.
Well, I mean, that one captain. We don't really know about the rest of his crew. They could have been fine. You know, who knows?
Yeah.
I'm going to assume they were fine. I'm not a racist like Grace.
I'm not a racist, I just think that Vulcan was douchey.
Well, he was. I'm certainly not going to disagree with you on that one.
Moving along.
So, I don't want
to
put...
He was getting close to Ponfar, just, you know, maybe, who knows, but...
Did he have, like, a baseball fetish or something? Or...
Sort of. He seemed to have a fetish with Sisko.
Yeah, maybe that was his roundabout way of trying to woo Sisko.
Yeah, or like a really, like some kind of bizarre obsession with Sisko. He's kind of like, Sisko likes baseball, so I'm going to learn the bejesus out of this game and impress him, and he will eventually have to admit how cool I am, and then we can live together in peace and harmony and, you know, ride off into the sunset or something. I'm just saying that Vulcan is a psychological gold mine. All right, so I don't want to spend too much time on this next point because it's you know kind of a giant rumor at this point. So there's been a rumor floating around that two new writers have been added to the next Star Trek film, which they're annoyingly calling Star Trek 3, which makes it hard to search for because it's you know not Star Trek 3. Star Trek 3 is already a movie.
Yeah, they did that with Stid. They were calling it Star Trek 2 for a while, and it's like, no, there's already a 2.
There's already...
It's like Star Trek, what, 14, or what is it, 13, 14?
Yeah.
The next one?
This one is Star Trek 13, I'm pretty sure. Wait, no, it's more than that, because, okay, so Star Trek 6, and the Generations is 7.
Moving on!
No, seriously, Grace, I want to know this. All right, and then Insurrection, or sorry, First Contact 8, 9, 10... So this is actually... Yeah, this is Star Trek 13. No, I was wrong the whole time. Okay. But and I mean, I can sort of accept that they just didn't give the 2009 movie a subtitle. It's just called Star Trek.
Yeah.
I mean, it's annoying. It's why I call it Star Trek the Star Trek. But it's at least
Star Trek the Trekking.
Yeah, you know, it's at least technically correct because no other movie was actually just called Star Trek. It was Star Trek the Motion Picture.
It was about a specific trek through the stars.
Yeah, but this Star Trek 3 is already a thing. But okay, so you can usually find it if you search for Star Trek 2015, although it might actually come out in 2016. But my original point was that the two writers that may or may not have been added to it are Ashley Miller and Zach Stentz. And I was trying to find some information about them, and I think they might be clones.
Clones?
Yeah. I think they're the same person, because they have exactly the same IMDb page. Like, you can just look at it, and it's all the same credits. And it's like, I think what they actually are is like a writing team.
Yeah.
But
they could be conjoined twins.
Even a writing team, I would assume, would have some kind of, you know, would have some different credits. And one of them has, like, a very full Wikipedia page, and the other one's Wikipedia page is really tiny, which leads me to suspect that they're clones, and the one of them is just a fake identity for some reason.
I'm going to stick with my conjoined twin theory. It's just one of them is the parasitic twin.
That's possible.
Yeah.
Wait. Are they binars and they're always stuck at the hip together and then talk in code?
I was thinking more like in that X-Files episode where the guy's got like the twin coming out of his chest or something.
Ooh. Or Quato. Open your mind.
That's the one where they like investigate the murder circus, right?
But
they got a bunch of actual like circus and freak show performers to be in the episode.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good episode. I like it. Although, I mean, I'm not sure if it may or may not have been kind of, I don't know, it may have been kind of unfortunate to cast circus performers in such an unfriendly light, but then again, I haven't seen it for a while, so maybe it didn't actually do that.
I thought it was alright.
Yeah, I mean, I remember liking it.
As a person who is of Carney descent.
Oh, really? Your ancestors roamed the land selling stale popcorn?
Yep.
Okay, well, good for you.
I'm...
All right, well, we have no emails this week, which leads me to believe I'm not working hard enough because I haven't pissed anybody off.
Our listeners
is Christopher 13 on is Christopher 13 on vacation?
I think he's mad at me. I think I did something. I'm not sure what exactly.
Uh-oh.
But I think I've offended everyone, and now
you need to bring him back now.
But not enough offending. Like I either need to offend them less or offend them more. I'm at the
perfect, is it?
The wrong level of offending is what's going on here. So I do want to, for anyone listening, if you want to do all things Trek a favor, we would appreciate it if you would go on to iTunes and rate us, give us a review of some kind. I will not ask you for a 5-star review. If you feel that we deserve a 5-star review, you may give us one. But if you feel that we do not deserve a 5-star review, you should give us what you feel is honest and what we actually deserve.
Give us some activity, if you will.
Yeah, we used to have a bunch of reviews, but then we had to change iTunes feeds, and they all disappeared. Hi, Stony. Stony's in the chat room. He said hello.
Hey.
All right.
We have all these idlers here, but no actual chatting. It's a slow day.
Well, it is a slow day, which is weird. It's not like a holiday or anything. It feels like a slow day, because, like, maybe that's because we stayed up all night drinking cider. The thing we did.
You guys had your cider party, didn't you?
Yeah, we did. A lot of alcoholic cider was drank. And we tried to play a bunch of Space Truckers, which is a game. It's kind of a funny game. You try to build your space truck, and then you try to send it into space, and it gets, you know, destroyed by asteroids. Always by asteroids. And if not by asteroids, then by pirates.
So you get to have a space convoy rocking through the night?
Yeah, basically.
Well, yesterday was a big day for me, too, actually.
Oh, yeah? What was it?
Yesterday was the day that I finished up what has potential to be the last essay of my college career. Yeah.
What was it on?
Yeah. What?
What was it on?
It was on it was a critical analysis of Alfred Hitchcock's Rear Window.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Ooh, nice.
That sounds interesting.
Oh yeah. Well, I had to do a lot of padding by the end, but what do you expect?
Well, that is sort of a thing that can happen. I haven't actually seen or read that particular. I assume
what? That's like the best one.
I'm sorry, I haven't seen a lot of movies.
Orin,
you have to think.
You're breaking my balls here.
I wasn't allowed to watch a lot of things when I was growing up. Okay, remember that? Orin,
it's from 1954.
Right, but what that means is that when I got to college, I had a lot of things I needed to catch up on. So I didn't have time to become more cultured. I had to watch all the things that everyone else already knew from being a kid.
It's Jimmy Stewart, you Philistine.
Netflix.
Netflix. To Netflix. Okay. I think that clears up our pre-show business. So for today, for our main topic, we are going to be discussing civilian life in the Federation. Which was suggested by a listener.
Such as it is.
Such as it is. that was a listener suggested topic. So keep that in mind, listeners. You guys can suggest topics, and then we might do them.
Yeah, we're easy like that.
When I feel like it. I'm almost skipping to the end here, but because I just watched Ensigns of Command. That episode is so good.
Yeah.
I haven't. That's one of those episodes that gets better every time you watch it. Like, repeat viewings make it more interesting because there's all this new stuff that you didn't notice the first time. Like, has it been a while since you guys have seen it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Sorry.
No, it's cool. I just want to know if I should recap it. I probably should anyway. For
recap. Recap.
Okay. Excuse me. I might have to sneeze. No. Okay.
Are you pregnant? Wait, you're not Bajoran.
You jinxed it.
I'm pretty sure that Grace is the Bajoran one. That's what our 100th episode poster says. I'm either a Vulcan or there was some other race that people suggested I might be. It might have been that race from Enterprise that was easily offended. I prefer to think of myself as a Vulcan, but you know, it's kind of like when you ask people what kid in Charlie and the Chocolate Factory do they identify with. They all say I'm more like Willy Wonka or Charlie. It's like, no, you're one of the bad kids. We all know them.
Violet Beauregard, all the way.
I mean, you know, I think most of us are all of them at some point or another, because they all sort of just represent basic, you know, aspects of our behavior. Oh, right, Stony, it was Tellarites. That's the other race I am. That's what people think, because Tellarites are argumentative and you know, pig-like.
They're haters like Orin.
Pretty much. Describes me very well. Ensigns of Command is episode 2 of season 3. And it is, the premise is that the Enterprise gets finds out about this unknown human colony that is in space claimed by the Sheliak, who are a one-off race that unfortunately we'll never see again, because I think there was a lot of potential in the Sheliak. But the basic thing is that these people, by accident of, like, navigational problems, have a colony that was established inside Sheliak space. And according to the treaty, the Sheliak own that planet, can do whatever they want with it. Because there were never supposed to be human colonies there, so it was never, like, assumed that this might come up. But now that there's, like, a dual problem going on, where Data has to go down and convince the colonists that they need to evacuate, and then Picard and Troi, who is useful in this episode, and I was like,
what?
Yeah, I know, right? Troi and Picard have to try to convince the Sheliak to give them enough time to, to evacuate. And it's not even really an A or B plot. It's just, like, it's two concurrent stories that are connected, are related, but not directly connected.
Yeah.
It's so good. Like, the Picard-Troi aspect is good because they're discussing the issues of communicating between people who you don't share a common view of the universe with, and Troi is giving Picard helpful advice and, like, standing at his side and advising him, which is what she should have been doing all the time.
So she's actually doing her job?
Exactly. She's doing
what?
She is doing her job in a competent manner. And, like, Picard is using a mixture of diplomacy, tact, and brinkmanship, and it's like this really interesting negotiation, and then like Data is down on the planet trying to deal with, because the reason they sent Data is because there was like radiation down there that would that the colonists were immune to, but would have killed any of the normal crew.
That's convenient.
Yeah, I mean it's a little convenient, but they kind of made it work. They were like, it was that this was radiation that, given enough time and enough therapy, you could adapt to. Which I don't know if that's actually feasible or not with how radiation works.
Couldn't tell ya.
Probably not. But in any case, it worked, and that basically the backstory of this colony is that a lot of them died when they first got to this planet because of the radiation before they learned how to adapt to it. So if they'd sent down a bunch of humans from the Enterprise crew, like half of them would have died.
Yeah.
So it was a little bit convenient, but it was
a Data ex machina.
Yeah, but it worked as a justification for sending Data down there. And,
yeah.
Like, Data is trying to convince the colonists, and he's running into problems of, which is honestly a problem that I think even normal people would run into, but it's kind of exacerbated with Data, where he's trying to be reasonable and explain what's actually going on, and he's dealing with this colony leader who is using his oratory and rhetoric skills and being convincing rather than reasonable.
What a jerk.
I know, right?
How dare he play to his strengths.
And, like, it is just very poignant to watch Data try to work through these problems. And they gave Data, like, a friend who is, like, the local robotics enthusiast, basically. And she's cool, too. Like, it's sort of a Data romance subplot, in that they don't really hit you over the head with it, but it is sort of, you know, she's clearly kind of interested in him, and he doesn't really have the capacity to respond, so it's, you know, I liked it a lot. And then there's even, like, sort of a very minor C plot where Geordi
one plot is never enough.
No, never enough. Where like Geordi and Wesley and O'Brien are trying to modify the transporters so that they won't have to rely on shuttlecraft, because apparently the radiation also breaks transporters, you know, why not? and it's a little bit sad.
Mm-hmm.
Say what, Grace?
Because it can.
Yeah. And it's a little bit sad that O'Brien doesn't get any lines. But, you know, it's funny, you know, it also kind of subverts your expectations, because you keep expecting, like, Geordi to come through with, like, a miracle tech solution, and in the end he's just like, nope, I said it was impossible when I started, and it still is.
I was right, suckers!
Like, you know, I didn't say it was impossible just for funsies. It's such a good episode. Although,
well, what bearing, like, there's so many great episodes, and it's cool when we see one that we didn't see for a long time and, like, are reminded how cool it is. Mm-hmm. But did this, like, have a bearing or a weight against the civilian topic thing? Is that, like, did they play into that with the colonist issue?
It does a bit. And it shows kind of a double side to life of a civilian in the Federation. Because, so, mostly what we've seen, and we haven't even seen a lot of it, but we mostly see life on Earth. And we can sort of extrapolate that it's mostly like that in the other, like, core systems of the Federation, right?
Mm-hmm.
But then, what you have is, because space is huge, right?
It's, like it is.
You know, there's something about it being the final frontier. what you end up with is a situation where people are out on the fringe, and this is not too different from what happens historically when you send colonists out into areas that are on the fringe of your government's control.
Uh-huh.
Is sometimes those colonists start doing things that you don't really want them to do, right?
Mm-hmm.
This was a major problem for the British in the Americas before the whole American Revolution thing.
Yep.
Because the British had signed treaties with a number of Native American tribes, and they said, all right, we'll stay on this side of our colony line, and then we'll have trade relations with you. A bunch of American colonists were like, no, man, we want that land over there. We're gonna go settle.
A good movie with that as the plot is Aguirre, The Wrath of God.
Say what now?
It's a German movie about Spanish explorers, and they end up in pretty much the middle of nowhere in Latin America, and they're like, hey, Spain isn't around, we'll start our own country, and it all goes horribly wrong.
Yeah, I mean, it's you know, you got the same thing, you know, in
it's
the...
It's like Lord of the Flies, but, you know, with Germans pretending to be Spaniards.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, it's okay. British people can pretend to be French people, so it kind of works out, right?
Yeah, I guess. Everyone can be anyone, as long as they're white.
As long as they're white. Which, speaking of which, is another good thing about Ensigns of Command, is that the colony is not all white.
Hey!
It's still, like, pretty white. Like, it could have done to be less white, but it wasn't all white. And one of the major characters was an African-American dude. So, like, I would have preferred if there had been, like, some Asians in the mix, and, you know, maybe some Latin Americans or just some, or people from the Middle East, but...
So, on a scale of Connecticut to Oakland, how white are we talking here?
I don't know. Maybe Austin?
Okay.
I think we're Austin levels of white? I haven't been to Austin for a really long time. I apologize to my people who live in Austin. I just picked a city off the top of my head. But, okay, what was this? All right, so...
I don't even know.
I've been distracted by Austin, okay? It's a thing that happened. But, so the point about Ensigns of Command is that... So here you have these civilians who are way out on the frontier.
Yeah.
And there's a conflict that brews between them and the Federation government. Because they want to live on this planet, and the Federation is like, you can't live on this planet. We signed a treaty that says you can't. And they're like, well, maybe we don't want to be part of the Federation anymore. And that's a very complicated issue right there. And unlike the people back on Earth, these colonists didn't have everything that they always needed, right? They had to, you know, suffer and die to get all the food and water that they needed to survive on this planet, to say nothing about the radiation. So it's, you know, it's...
That's a phrase you don't get to use very often, is it? To say nothing of the radiation.
To say nothing of the radiation. You know, that little thing.
That old chestnut.
Also, the fact that Data comes in and stuns all of them at the end is also really funny. I enjoy that scene, too, where they're like, we're gonna defend our aqueduct, and Data is like, no, bam, bam, bam. Which, you know, I there's a couple of seconds where I'm kind of wondering why the colonists aren't taking shots at him in that scene. I guess the justification I come up with is that none of these people were trained as soldiers.
That would make sense, yeah.
Because it's kind of like, you know, in the military, you have to train people to fire at humanoid-shaped targets, because most people have kind of an innate desire not to hurt other people.
Mm-hmm.
As surprising as that seems with all the violence we keep hearing about all the time. You have to train them to overcome that. And so I would imagine these colonists, never having gotten that training, you know, would just hesitate when they were... Whereas Data doesn't have that problem because, you know, he can just turn off that part of his subroutines and be like, nope, it's time to shoot some colonists. Because why not?
Because they can.
Although I am a little bit puzzled about what's supposed to have happened when he shoots the aqueduct and it, like, zooms out and shows this special effect of... like a bunch of like what looks like an energy pulse traveling up the aqueduct, and I'm just like, what is going on there? Like, what did the phaser do to make that happen? Which is not really relevant to my point. It was something that struck out at me when I was watching it.
Mm-hmm.
Who knows? But all right. So talking more about civilians,
mm-hmm.
If we can. That was something I wanted to talk about immediately, because I literally just finished watching it, and it is immediately on my mind. So, in the Federation, I would ask you guys, if you lived on a major Federation planet in, like, the TNG Deep Space Nine era, what do you think you would do?
I want to be a bartender.
You want to be a bartender?
Like, old-timey Western style. You know, like, you'd get to just hang out in the bar and watch people fight and dispense advice and stuff.
Hmm.
And be like, you don't look like you're from around here, hombre.
Okay.
Yeah.
David?
Another variation on Guinan.
That yeah. Could be cool. Except I could be me. So.
Yeah, not a carbon copy of Guinan, but just being in that kind of position, that could be cool.
Yeah, I think that'd be a fun niche to fill. It's a
yeah, and
over.
And it'd be like a service role too, so you could kind of feel good that you're, you know, helping people, providing a service. That's the kind of thing I weirdly enough, a while back, like a long time ago, I did think about that. Because I used to always think, like, I want to be in Starfleet, you know, when especially when TNG was first starting and then early DS9, especially on DS9 when we saw more of the, you know, alien stuff, and there was the kiosks with, you know, either restaurants or selling those, what were they, the Jumja sticks?
Jumja sticks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Those are always cool.
Apparently they're really
sweet.
So
I used to think, yeah, they look like it. It looks like a big glob of, like, hardened sugary stuff on a stick, which is always
fruit.
Everything.
I always thought it was like a chunk of fruit or something.
Yeah, that could be it. But everything's better on a stick. But I did think about, you know, on one hand, me personally, like in real life, I've always been a drawer. Like I always, you know, with pencil, and every now and then I would get, you know, I would dabble with chalk, charcoal. A lot of people said I should try my hand at like oil painting, but I've been drawing all my life. And so I used to think I would be an artist, you know, exploring that thing. But then I used to think, well, as cool or fun as that might be, is that too like self-serving? And I would want to provide a service or, you know, in some way help other people. And so I've kind of wondered, you know, what roles would there be for that in the future of the Federation? And so I kind of thought, you know,
especially for a fine, outstanding Klingon like yourself.
Right. Well, exactly. And in that case, maybe I could relate to the Klingon restaurateur on Deep Space Nine. And I might go in that direction because almost like, you know, I know we are going to talk about it, at some point or later on, but Joseph Sisko with his restaurant, and then we've seen other people having, you know, just enjoying cooking, and I also enjoy cooking. I, you know, my brother and some of the people in the family, they just want to, like, you know, sit back and then have the finished meal, you know, presented, and then they enjoy it. Whereas I always like being involved in the cooking process, you know, actually. On one hand, just to, you know, tailor it to my own specific taste, like, you know, more of this, less of that. And so I would say, like, nah, screw that. I want to make it so it's like the way I want it. But then
it's a science. It's really fun. You get to, like, do kitchen alchemy. And that's how you, and when you serve up your meal, you're able to say, yeah, I did that.
Yep. Yeah. There's some, like, pride, some, you know, satisfaction of accomplishing something. And like you said, like, almost the experimentation of, will these two things go together? Will they not? How will it turn out? And so I could either see myself either being an artist, mm-hmm. or, you know, maybe having some connection with cooking or a restaurant of some sort. Mm-hmm. But other than that, I don't know. I've always, there's different directions I could go with that. I've always kind of liked tinkering. I've, you know, been able to put together computers and stuff. So maybe, but I don't know if that would actually lead into be more of like a Federation job, like almost an O'Brien, mm-hmm. of engineering or something. But if it was totally civilian, I could probably say either an artist or, you know, kitchen restaurant type person, maybe the future Gordon Ramsay or something.
He would be a Klingon, wouldn't he?
And I would like to
grab say.
I would like to point out that I just from my own personal belief is that society does need artists. I don't consider art to be an optional thing for society. Because imagine what society would look like if we didn't have art.
It would suck.
It would be terrible. It would be like, you know, I mean, it would not be pleasant.
My house would be empty.
And I mean,
and there's so many ways that art, the word art, the concept manifests. You know, there's the visual arts, the performing arts, music, you know, sculpting, painting, all of it. You know, art really does, you know, shape a culture.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, the reason I asked this question was because the Federation, as it is portrayed, they don't use money, right?
Yeah.
Now, and there is, they don't really go into the details of this, but there is assumptions that due to some either a Federation government social program or just because of the abundance of technology, that you can all pretty much be guaranteed that you're always going to have a roof over your head and enough food to eat, right?
That's convenient.
Which is good. I mean, I think that's
blankets and
I was going to say, I think that's something that we should all pretty much be be going for. And I think that even if you were, like, say, someone like Jake, who kind of seems to want to lounge around for a living, you probably wouldn't be dumped out on the street.
He's a writer, Orin. God.
Well, he eventually becomes
a
writer. He does the journalist thing for a while.
Yeah, and
he becomes like a news reporter for a while, but then later on he turns into like a novelist, like, you know, fiction writer. And that could be another, you know, good thing of historian or just, you know, make up stories that other people would read on their...
There's a lot to be done in a universe of the Federation.
Mm-hmm.
Their, you know, Kindles or whatever what they call it back then. But I know that not like it wasn't homework really, but we talked about the home front that we were going to talk about that episode.
Yeah.
And, you know, but then also when I started thinking about what episodes come to mind about civilian life in the Federation worlds or whatever. And so an episode that I watched for that was Family, the Next Generation episode, Family.
Yeah.
And that's the one right after The Best of Both Worlds, where you see Picard. And most people think about it's the one where Picard goes back to his home and, you know, deals with his brother and that whole thing. But then I had kind of forgotten, or I just didn't associate it that they were the same episode, is that's when Worf is dealing with his parents again.
Yeah.
And then there's another subplot about, which doesn't really relate to the civilian thing, but it's also when Wesley gets that data chip from his father, and he's watching the holodeck program of his young, you know, and so there was that, you know, cool thing. But so it had both of those elements of seeing Marie and Robert with Renee, you know, at the Picard family, at the house, the estate, which was also a vineyard. They were vintners, right? They were doing the whole wine thing.
Chateau Picard.
And so, I mean, and that could be a kind of a topic to talk about there, about, you know, they're providing a service, but the other side of it was showing Sergei and Helena Roshenko, and they didn't really talk about what they do for a living, other than Sergei was a retired engineer, you know, who served on the Intrepid, which was an Excelsior class. And that's, of course, he's like, I got all the specs and diagrams, because he wanted to see the Enterprise.
Probably the guy who had to replace those parts that Scotty tore out of the Excelsior's transwarp drive.
Yeah.
Oh, man, yep. And so we don't get to see too much of their, you know, home life or their personal, you know, how they do day to day. But at least we get to see a lot of, and it kind of relates to what you were talking about the technology and the money issue somewhat of, there's a point where, you know, it's the first time they all sit down for dinner. And so, you know, Renee's saying, I wrote an article. I wrote an essay for school. I'm going to be a starship captain. And Picard is, you know, then they're like, so tell us about what's going on with you, Picard. And, you know, it's a family talk around the table. Yeah. But it gets back to what Marie calls a very old argument in the Picard family, which would have been between the father and the mother. And now it was being shown between Picard and his brother, Robert.
Mm-hmm.
And that was about, because obviously we see Robert all about the wine, right? And when they first meet, he's like, hi, Picard, great. I got it now, you know, go back to the house. I got to fix this, you know,
broken. I'm in the field doing grapes.
Yeah, he's got to heal the vine thing. And so he's all about that. And at one point in the episode, he's like keeping the traditions alive and type of thing. And then when you get to that dinner, he's like, you know, tastes great, you know, very well done, Marie, with the food. And that brings up the old argument of home cooking, like handmade cooking versus the replicator.
Yeah.
And I was paying close attention because throughout the whole thing, it was about, like, should we get a replicator or not, was all about, is almost in a way you could think of it almost like a microwave or something. They're like, it would make things some things more convenient. And Robert's like, you know, life is already too convenient. But they never once said it would be too expensive or like, oh, we could afford it or anything about having to purchase, you know, of that being an issue. Was just, do we want one or not? And that made me think, well, does every family just say, I want a replicator, and then they just get issued one for free? Like, you know what I mean? It's like they never once said, it was just never a concern or brought up as a thing. It's like, well, we could afford one, or, you know, even a cheap one would help us, or nothing like that. So it was just, I guess, free replicators for everybody.
Well, this is going to be a little out there, but what if the whole whether or not to get a replicator argument was based, and this is going to sound a little out there, in like a sense of cultural appropriation?
Oh, yeah?
If you can follow me. Like, what if there's a set amount of things that you can get from a replicator and stuff, but you can't get like authentic French food or what have you like that? Right. Like different, very specific regional stuff, and they're like, "No, we're gonna make our own food like we always have."
No, and I think that would
explain Cisco's dad's restaurant, wouldn't it?
Yeah, and I think that's legitimate. Exactly. There seems to be, since we're on this topic, there seems to be a fair amount of anti-technology thought in the Federation, which is interesting for a society that depends so highly on technology. There's the debate in Star Trek between characters over whether or not replicated food tastes as good as the real thing, right? And different episodes seem to answer it different ways. And it's pretty clear that with Picard's family, you know, Robert, I think, is his brother?
Yeah.
He doesn't want to get a replicator, and he clearly could be using more advanced means of making his wine, right?
But he's an artisanal vintner. That's what he has to do.
Yeah, he's doing it the old-fashioned way on purpose, not because he has to.
Uh-huh.
And he reacts almost violently at Picard's technological intrusion into his home, right?
Mm-hmm.
He and Picard have a fight about, obviously, their own unresolved issues.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have, Sisko's dad, who is all about, you know, no son of mine is going to eat that replicated slop Starfleet calls food. I believe is a accurate quote.
Yeah.
Of
this. Like, yeah, and even prawns and everything at his restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
And when he says that, even Sisko says, like, you'll get no argument from me. Like, so in a way, that's like, I almost look at it like they've gotten better. You could get more options, but it's almost like replicated food would be looked at almost as like field rations.
Yeah.
We see that they still have, you know, the MREs, the field rations that we've seen O'Brien talk about, but even the replicated food, you know, we've seen it with the Klingons saying, you know, when Worf says replicated blood wine doesn't do justice or whatever to the real, and then
like
sent the hall with the wine.
Say what, Grace?
Yeah. I mean,
it's like fast food for them. I mean, it's been adjusted to be healthy and still, but it still came out of a machine and all that.
What were you saying, David?
It's not going to be nuanced with the right amount of seasoning or, you know, that
it
type of thing.
And
it's
not dying.
And isn't it a little bit, have you ever wondered if how much of that is psychological? Like, I'd be interested to see
a Star Trek. Yeah, how much of that is psychosomatic?
Yeah, like, I'd be interested to see them do a Star Trek blind taste test. Granted, you can't do this in real life, obviously, because the replicator's not real. But, you know, if you could do it in a Star Trek episode, have, like, you know, maybe they won't, just because that would have to answer the question, and I don't know if the Star Trek writers actually know what the answer is. But it's a distinct possibility that people are like, this replicated food doesn't taste as good as the real thing, but if you gave them, you know, two dishes and one was replicated and one was made by hand, they might not be able to tell the difference.
Mm-hmm.
And that and it's like just, you know, even to bring this back to A Measure of a Man just a little bit, not The Measure of a Man, excuse me, Ensigns of Command, Data comments that his fellow musicians say that his music lacks soul.
Yeah.
And I kind of have to wonder, what does that mean? Like, is that just because he's an android? Is that, like, why they're saying that? Could they actually define what they mean by it lacks soul? Or are they
he's probably an improviser, for one thing.
Say what?
He probably can't improvise, for one thing.
Yeah, that's possible.
Easily speaking.
That's possible.
or play anything by ear.
Mm-hmm. And it, on the subject of food, it kind of makes me wonder, obviously with replicators this wouldn't be as much of an issue, but we know that the Federation didn't use money for significantly before replicators existed. Because, like, you know, Captain Kirk is, at least later in TOS and in the movies, comments that they don't use money, even though they they actually make some references to it in early TOS, but, you know, Star Trek's not always consistent.
What?
What?
Go on.
Okay, so before the Replicator, they still had a currency-less economy, so the question at that point is, where do they get their food from? Because, like, we've all talked about what we would want to do in this society, and it's all, like, you know, stuff that we think would be... It would provide an important service, you know, be it bartending or artistry. But, like, how many people, if you ask them what they'd love to do in a society where they can do anything, would say, I want to be a farmer? Like, there might be some.
I'm sure there would be some that would, that even in today's society or in the future, would say, I'd love to be a farmer. I want to be in the soil, you know, all day, all night.
Yeah, and then there would be people that's like... Thing.
Yeah, gardening, whether it's just, you know, flowers like Boothby or, you know, vegetables for food. But then I'm sure there's other people that's like, you couldn't pay me $1 million to be a gardener. It's like, I hate that. I would never want to do that. So there, but like what I thought you were going to say is who would say, well, I want to be like the janitor, or yeah, I want to be like, you know, the person that goes down into the sewer systems or whatever. And like just, and maybe those are the jobs that, well, they're not going to get paid, but maybe they would get compensated.
Those are community service jobs. That's my theory. Yeah. I'm sticking with it.
That's the Federation's equivalent of the swear jar. If you're rude, if you're rude to someone in the street, you have to go, you know, fix a toilet. And I mean, the reason I brought up food instead of immediately, because David, the janitor thing is totally legit. That's a good question to ask. The reason I brought up food is just because if you're gonna be feeding a massive population, you need to be doing a lot more than, you know, having a garden in your backyard, right? Like the kind of farming that Robert was doing. Now, granted, he was doing grapes, but if he'd been growing a food crop like rice or corn, you would need a lot of him to feed a population of Earth, right? Like you wouldn't just. And I've heard some estimates nowadays that with modern technology, we could have as little as 2% of our population in food production and have more than enough to feed everyone. And I don't know how accurate that is, but I would imagine that they would need to have maybe like somewhere they would need to have huge, like mainly automated, like farming networks to be able to get enough food for everyone. Mm-hmm. And I have to wonder who would, maybe they're, I can't help but feel like the Federation would have to have, going to the janitor thing, the Federation would have to have a rotational system where you have to spend like a week out of every month doing, or maybe not even that much, but like a certain amount of time is set aside where you will do the necessary jobs that you might not necessarily want to do, right?
Well, yeah. I have often heard people say everyone should have to work a service job at least once in their life to learn humility and stuff like that.
Right, right.
Yeah.
But, and I mean, nowadays we depend on people's need of money to get them to do those jobs, right?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
We are like, well, you need to feed yourself and put a roof over your head, so you're going to take this janitor job even if you hate doing it, which I don't think is a terribly healthy way of doing things, but that's how we do it nowadays.
Or if you're in the capacity where that's the only thing you're skill-wise capable of doing.
Sure. But I would think that in the Federation, with the other potential option, because Riker apparently makes some crack somewhere about how the Enterprise cleans itself. I don't remember when he said that, but I've heard that quoted a couple of times. But barring like an army of invisible cleaning robots...
House elves?
Oh, God. Do not get me started on house elves. The house elves...
Right.
House elves will rise again.
Roombas, like the little exocomps.
Yeah, it's exocomps. It's always the exocomps. You ever notice that robot that Alexander has in Rascals looks a lot like a Roomba? He's got like a little... It's got like a little remote control car, and I'm like, that looks exactly like a Roomba. Like Roombas Roombas didn't exist back then when they made that episode, but I'm not entirely unsure that whoever is in charge of Roombas didn't watch that episode and is like, that's what our machine is going to look like.
Star Trek predicts the future again.
So yeah, assuming that we aren't using robots, because when we actually see Earth and other Federation planets, there's no evidence that these robots exist. In fact, the Federation seems to be very anti-robotics. I would imagine that they would have to employ some kind of rotational system where, like, you know, you can have your awesome job where you're an artist all day, or where you get to, you know, operate your cool like Western style saloon or what have you. But, you know, maybe one day out of every month you have to go and sign up with the janitorial crew and, like, go, you know, clean out the sewers or whatever. Or some other job that you didn't really, or you know, change bedpans in a hospital. Because that's, I don't think we would have any shortage of people who want to be doctors. But people who want to, you know, be bedpan changers, that might not be as easy to get a hold of.
Well, that's probably what they just make you do if you're, like, the new doctor or something, if you're a trainee.
Maybe, it's possible.
That's your hazing right there.
Well, here's another thought, that because I did think about maybe there would be, like, a, if not a rotational system, but maybe somehow the Federation has, like, a service corps where you have to, like, start, you know, quote, from the bottom and then work your way up. But the thing I thought of it was, like, because I think in a way we're talking about the average Joe, you know, Joe Blow citizen, John Q citizen, whatever you want to call it, where they're not doing, definitely not in Starfleet, and they're not a Federation diplomat type of thing, like, you know, servicing the United Federation of Planets without being in Starfleet. But I've kind of thought there seems like there still would be a difference between, you know, just Joseph Sisko running his restaurant, you know, he's just totally doing his own thing, versus one of the time, like, when we first were going to say, okay, we're going to talk about civilian life, my mind just quickly went to, like, non-Starfleet. Mm-hmm. And I thought, okay, so it's Federation people. And I started thinking of, like, Leah Brahms and some of the people that we've seen that, like, are Federation scientists or engineers or doing that stuff. And then I had to think, well, wait a minute. Let's go total civilian, because they may still be, you know, not considered a civilian if they're doing, you know, like, you know, designing starships for the Federation. And so that's why I started thinking about, you know, Joseph Sisko and Robert and all them. But then I also looked at, in that episode, Family, Picard at a point is thinking, should I leave Starfleet? You know, should I stay home and reconnect with my family and my roots, but then also
do something about this whole PTSD mess?
Right, and exactly. And then that's when it ties into the subplot of, if he leaves Starfleet, he would be working with his old friend, I forget his name, but the guy that's working in the ocean. And there's a name, I think it was called, like, the Atlantis Project or the Atlantis something, I forget, I didn't write it down, but, and that made me think,
undersea colony.
Well, and right there, and the whole premise was he was trying to raise the ocean floor in order to make another subcontinent under the ocean for, you know, housing and, you know, populate it, you know, urban sprawl, I guess, under the sea. But and so
there's a strip mall under the sea.
I got it.
And so I don't think just, like, if Joseph Sisko, like, we're just bringing him up again, like, there's going to be other people like Joseph Sisko that are running the Mexican restaurant or the Japanese, Chinese restaurant, whatever, or, you know, Italian or what. It's not even almost a tailor. What if a person wants to be a fashion, you know, clothing designer and they're running a store similar to Sisko's restaurant, but it's a clothing thing?
So
I don't think those people. Well, yeah, Garrick, you know, retires on Earth or something. But I don't think those people could have just said, hey, ocean, you know, developer people, I want to join. Let's, you know, take me down there and I'll help you. It kind of made me think that there has to be some level or some form of, whether they're Federation, you know, sponsored or like under the auspices of the Federation Council or whatever, or if they're totally independent.
Or something.
Say what, Grace?
Right.
Or Federation grant or something.
Mm-hmm.
Right, a grant or using their resources. Like the ocean people, they have to be organized. You have to be, like, able to join them. So maybe there's, like, a Federation sanctioned, like, service corps where it's like there's people that are just going to run a restaurant or sculpt or make music or, you know, design dresses. But then there's the people that's like, I do want to serve. I want to help. I want to be a part of something. And they would join like the Federation Service Corps. Because obviously there's like the Federation, the Corps of Engineers. Mm-hmm. They would be designing the starships for the Federation or whatever. But what if it's the people that are doing that same type of thing, but they're not designing starships or star bases or anything for space. They're just doing that same type of work, but for the planet, you know, down on the ground. And maybe that's where you would get the people that would be like the janitors, the people that are like doing the service jobs, you know, that's not just a restaurant.
Yeah, I kind of like that. I mean, Stony in the chat room was suggesting like a national service sort of thing that isn't really Starfleet, but it's still like a Federation entity,
mm-hmm.
Which I think would make a lot of sense. Grace, were you saying something?
No, I'm just going, eh.
Yeah. Yeah.
Noise is in agreement.
So another thing that I was thinking about, and this is, you know, kind of almost Federation government structure, but so, you know, we in our society right now, we don't have a perfect solution to what happens when we have a greater demand for a particular profession than there are people who want to be in that profession, right? Like right now, I think we're having, like nationally, we have a shortage of nurses. Like we need more nurses. Despite what you might think, the compensation for being a nurse has not gone up in proportion with our need for them, which is kind of not what I would hope would happen. But imagine, you know, you could have that same kind of problem in the Federation where, like, you know, imagine the Federation, like in the Federation, you have like a couple of years where people just for whatever reason decide they're not really all that interested in being engineers, but the Federation needs engineers. Like, you know, if it got really bad, you know, we kind of depend on the lure of money to try to convince people to go do those jobs. I wonder.
It's like a compulsory thing, like joining the army in Israel.
Yeah, it could be. Like, so do we think that the Federation has has certain quotas it has to meet where it's like we need a certain number of people doing these jobs in order for our society to function smoothly? I wonder what kind of incentives the Federation uses to try to get people to do those jobs. If for some reason in one or two years there just aren't enough people in those jobs, because they can't, you know, they can't go and offer them money because they don't use money.
I don't know, better benefits.
Better benefits, that's a possibility. You know, maybe in the Federation you want people like having their stuff put up on a statue. Who knows? I mean, I would have to imagine, I think I've said this before, but I would imagine that the Federation would need to have a strong emphasis on, like, public service in their education system.
Yeah.
Because right now we have kind of an emphasis on how do you get a job, how do you get ahead, and I don't think that sort of thing would work in the Federation. I think you would need to really hit home on the idea of how can I help people around me sort of thing.
Yeah.
You know, ask not what your Federation can do for you, but ask
what you can do for your Federation.
Yeah, exactly.
I can dig it.
In the chat room, we have an interesting message from Kines? Kines? I don't know how to pronounce that.
Kines.
Kines. Says the UFO. Say what?
And Ferb.
Oh, okay. UFP charter agreements place Starfleet quotas we have to uphold. Which is an interesting idea. I'm not sure if that was just something that they thought was neat or if that's from a specific, like, you know, document. If it is, I'd be interested to hear where that was from. I think it is about time for a music break. How are you guys feeling about that?
I can go for a music break.
David, do you have some music for us?
Yep, right here we're going to go and listen to some Tim Russ, a.k.a. Tuvok, from Star Trek Voyager.
Born Tuvok.
You're listening to the podcast and archive of all things Trek. Music breaks have been cut out due to copyright reasons. If you'd like to hear the music, please tune in live Saturday 1 to 3 Pacific Time on Trek Radio.
And welcome back to all things Trek. One thing that I definitely... hang on. I had a point here. All right, so I actually have a request for anyone listening to this who can help me out. I want to do a Star Trek episode at some point on the book I Am Not Spock. I would really like to do that. Unfortunately, which is a good book, I've read it. Unfortunately, it's out of print, and it was never, as far as I know, it was never made into an ebook or an audiobook. And I would like Grace and David to be able to read it without spending a fair amount of money, because all the copies that I found online have been at least $20.
I'll see what I can pirate.
So if anyone listening to this knows of how to acquire an electronic or audio or even a hard copy at a cheap price, and please give me an email at allthingstrek@hotmail.com so we can hook up my other two co-hosts with this book. And because I don't even think I can find my copy. Like, if I could, I would just give it to Grace to borrow. But David lives kind of far away from me. That would be a bit of a problem. But I would definitely, I definitely want to.
I could call some of the used bookstores around here, see if they got a copy available. But I'm not going to hold my breath too much on that.
It's hard to find.
Try using, you know, Topcat or something.
It's not an easy to find book. So if anybody listening has a connection, I would be happy to hear it. Or of course, if you just want to send us email, because as we mentioned, we've been a little short in the last.
We're a little disappointed in you, listeners.
I wasn't going to phrase it like that, but I guess Grace.
I am.
Grace can be the bad cop here. All right.
I could be good cop if I tried.
Usually you're the good cop. Usually it's my job to be bad cop, which is why this is so refreshing and different. So, we talked a lot about the economics and the professional life of civilians in the Federation, but maybe talking a little bit more about aesthetics. What do you guys think what do you guys think that the Federation should look like?
Look like? In what sense?
Like, from what we've seen, most people have dressed very plainly, right?
Like fashion-wise. Yeah.
Like, and I mean, we can talk about, there are other aspects to that question, but let's focus on fashion first.
Oh boy.
Because, I mean, obviously the joke about Star Trek is that if you're in the, if you're civilian, you wear earth tones.
Yeah.
Right? Like, that's the joke. But I would have to imagine that it wouldn't, you know, that it can't just be that, right? That just has to be kind of an unfortunate side effect of what we see on television.
Yeah, earth tones is what you dress people in when you want them to look unimportant, pretty much.
Yeah. So what would
Well,
be...
but I saw that, though. I saw the comment, like, in the show notes about earth tones. But then when I was watching both Homefront, which was the DS9 episode about, you know, Sisko's... the restaurant, and then also Family, the TNG episode, Renee, Robert, and Marie, I mean, no, hold on, Renee, the young nephew, and Robert were in earth tones, but Marie, Robert's wife, Picard's sister-in-law, she was like in pink and light lavender, so she had some color to her. And then if you look at Joseph Sisko, he had a royal blue, like a deep, rich blue shirt that had like a purple panel, like, you know, almost like a lapel, but it was just one that went diagonal that was purple. And then Sergei, he was in earth tones, but then Helena Roshenko, she was in like a dark blue dress. So it seems like it's either earth tones or a blue-purple, purple-pink combination. It's kind of trippy.
Well, rules are only there when they're followed, I guess.
So, that's an interesting difference, is that when we do have some people who aren't dressing in earth tones, but most of that does, it still seems pretty much like, I can imagine someone walking down the street in those outfits. But I would have to imagine that fashion in the future would be significantly different looking, right? Especially if we have replicators, when you can make whatever clothes you want.
Yeah, you'd think fashion would be more radical in the future.
Like, I would just figure people... So, what was that, Dave?
Well, that's where Garrick comes in with all of his outfits. And then I also watched again, or I didn't watch the whole episode, but I went back in on Netflix and took glances across the DS9 Risa episode, Let He Without Sin, about the Essentialists, right? And they're in, like, long drab robes or whatever. But Quark, Bashir, Lita, and some of the other people, they're in bright colors. So I think DS9, they're the fashion sense people. They like the weird colors and the weird designs.
Well, like freaking the Fun Police, those guys, I hate them so much. I think
the Essentialists.
Yeah, the Essentialists. Like, not only are they dressed boring, but they're dressed like completely inappropriately for the heat, right? Like,
he even mentions that in the episode. One of the first times they hold a little rally or a meeting, a thing. They're like, everybody gathers and they're in their swimsuits or tank tops and shorts or whatever, and they walk out and he's like, "You're probably laughing at me, sweating under the sun, but there's a reason for it." And then he goes into the whole thing about their spiel.
Is it essential to be uncomfortable, Mr. Essentialist?
I guess so.
You're right. I am laughing at you, but not in a good way. I always thought it was strange that we didn't see as many bright colors in Star Trek, considering what we saw in the original series, right? I mean,
yeah.
And like, the Star Trek uniforms are bright, at least in the beginning. They get progressively darker as the show goes forward. And I don't mean to say that they get, like, gloomier or seriouser. I just mean that the color is dark. Like, it started off bright red, and then, like, the further you get into the series, it gets a darker and darker red until finally it's a gray with, like, a kind of a maroon collar thing going on. But do you guys remember that episode of Deep Space Nine where Sisko runs into that woman in the red dress and she turns out to be, like, a psychic projection?
Yes.
I remember that.
Do you remember how striking it was that this woman showed up in a bright red dress?
Yeah, I do.
It was in such contrast to what everyone else is wearing. Like, even Quark, who is wearing, like, a suit, is very subdued. Like, his colors are not, you know, maybe that's just a television thing, right? Maybe it's just because those colors look better on film.
Honestly, I have no idea.
Well, even like in The Matrix, when Morpheus was showing Neo The Matrix for the first time, and it was like a little pocket bubble Matrix, like on their own system where they do the big, you know, rooftop jump. He takes it into a crowd and everybody's in whites and blacks and whatever. And then there's the girl in the red dress. Mm-hmm. So a vibrant, solid red dress is definitely going to stand out. But like, aside from her, another character that really stands out every time she shows up is Luoxana Troi, and she's in crazy colors, crazy patterns, and that stands out from even all the aliens walking around the promenade. So it is kind of interesting how they use design and color, or don't, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I could go on for days about my issues with costuming in Star Trek. I really could.
You know, Grace, I wish you would.
This is
the topic for it. Like, I mean, if for no other reason than, like, because with the Matrix thing, they did that on purpose, right? Because everyone is dressed the same, and then there's the woman in the red dress.
Yeah.
And they kind of used the same thing in the Deep Space Nine episode. It's like, whoa, it's a woman in a red dress. That's weird. Like, everyone in the Federation seems to dress very similarly.
The problem is when you're having a series like Star Trek and you're supposed to be representing this wide range of culture, and with that a wide range of stylistic choices, is they only have one costume designer at a time.
Yeah.
That's the big problem there.
And that costume designer's got a budget to work on.
Exactly. A budget to work on and a very strict stylistic palette they're working with, and that I feel like just about every Star Trek series has suffered because of that.
Mm-hmm.
Honestly,
No, I think that's true. And I mean, there's the joke is that in the Federation, everyone dresses the same. And
yes,
like, you know, to some people, the future portrayed by Starfleet or by Star Trek is actually terrifying because they, you know, they see a couple of episodes and are like, everyone dresses the same. And nobody does anything for fun except read books. This is terrifying.
Holodex,
yeah. And I mean, you know, and I can see why they think that, even though I think they're being a little bit knee-jerk, reactionary, and you know, taking things out of context.
Mm-hmm.
But I would, you know, obviously we would all like to see more variety in costumes, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you know,
definitely.
And Christopher 13, I think, pointed out, like, maybe a little bit more variety in body types.
That too, yeah.
For extras. But that's just a television problem, right? Like, that's not even a specific Star Trek-related problem. And I wonder if maybe they could fix that by having, like, just more shots with fewer people in them, but, like, more close-ups.
Maybe.
Like, because big crowd shots are going to be problematic, right? Because that's, like, you know, 100 people you have to costume.
Yeah.
And a lot of those guys are just going to be wearing street clothes. So it's going to look kind of just like modern day. But if you have, like, interior shots on alien planets, then you can really afford to get into, you know, what... Like, I really, really liked Ishka or Boogie.
Yeah.
Dress. Like, when she was wearing clothes, she had all those, like, spangly bits. And
she looked very alien, yeah.
And I thought that was really neat, and I thought it was funny that she looked more alien than any of the other Ferengi we'd seen up until that point. Like, her outfit was very out there.
Yeah.
I like Stoney's comment in the chat room that considering that red is very noticeable, it explains all the red shirt deaths. Just like, you know, the aliens choosing who to shoot at, and it's like, oh, that guy's in red. Blam.
I'll just kill the guy wearing the loudest outfit.
Exactly. This is why I thought it was funny in the episode where Picard gets operated on, like he has, like, they need to give him heart surgery.
Yeah.
All of the doctors are wearing these bright crimson surgical garbs. And I was like, oh, wow. That's relaxing.
His heart is going to explode and kill them all.
Probably.
Well, if they were operating on a Vulcan, would they have all worn green scrubs or blue for an Andorian, like just in case it splatters, they don't want to, you know, have
alarm
it be shocking.
Well, it's like the British, right, with the whole red shirt thing where they were like, we don't, you know, we wear the outfit is red so that if your friend next to you is bleeding, you won't notice. I have no idea if that's actually true. That's just an anecdote I've heard repeated a couple of times. But so in addition to fashion, because we would all expect there to be more variety in Star Trek fashion, and probably for people to just, you know, wake up one day and be like, you know, I'm gonna try wearing a giant bird on my head, just, you know, replicator, make it so.
Yes,
but, well, there is Guinan
home in the future.
Ooh, oh yeah, I'd love to see that. Well, and then we got Guinan with her crazy big hats.
I love Guinan's hats. I felt like there should be more hats. Have you ever noticed how few hats there are in Star Trek?
Yes. Thank you. God.
So few hats. What is up
with that? More hats!
Maybe the hats get in the way of the mind control rays that the Federation uses to keep all of its citizens in place. Boom.
Keep all of the citizens in the same aesthetic.
It's like, you're not allowed to wear hats. That interfere. No, 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 I've got it. You remember that Voyager episode where they established that Voyager is constantly monitoring everyone's brain waves? Hats get in the way of that.
Wow.
That's why you're not allowed to wear hats.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is, it's kind of funny when you think about, like, later episodes of Star Trek, or even earlier episodes, where they, like, they can't find someone on board because they've left their comm badge.
Yeah.
And it's like, just have the computer that's monitoring their brainwaves tell you where they are.
Or couldn't you, like, page them over a loudspeaker or something?
Well, I mean, the usually in those contexts, it's because they don't want to be found, right? They're like, I'm taking off my comm badge, so you can't find me. And sometimes they can find people with their comm badges, and sometimes they can't. Depends on the episode. But, so another question of how things would look. What about architecture? Because, again, we've seen San Francisco a couple of times, and it all looks very, you know, very, very modern, very low-key. Even in the Star Trek 2013 movie, other than that giant sign above the bar that said San Francisco, you know, in case you got really drunk and forgot what city you were in, it still looked, I'd say, fairly modern. Like, it's a little bit shinier than modern, but other than those, like, cars flying everywhere, it looked pretty normal.
Yeah.
There's, like, skyscrapers and stuff, which exist in regular cities. But what do you guys think 24th century architecture would look like?
I honestly have no idea.
No idea?
At first I want to, like, say, well, maybe like 60s futurism looking, because that's what they did with original Star Trek, and that's what you'd expect. But who knows? When it comes to talking theoretical architecture, I'm a little lost.
I'm imagining biodomes.
Yeah, probably a lot of geodesic type domes and triangles and, you know, stuff like that. But even if I'm starting to think, you know, I forget what countries they're in, because they're not all in the United States or, you know, England or that type of thing. But there are some of these super crazy skyscrapers that are going up around the world. And, you know, whether it's in like Dubai or I forget where they're at, but there are some really crazy looking skyscrapers that some of these countries are building that could look like they're from a science fiction, you know, movie or whatever, but they're in the real world, like, you know, twisty buildings or buildings that are curved in weird ways or whatever. And they're, you know, being built today or already have been built. And so when you look into the future, I could kind of see, for one, maybe they're not going to go so crazy because they're about, you know, minimalism or like the most efficient, you know, it's like we could build in crazy ways, but is that going to be the most efficient way to do it?
Mm-hmm.
But you know, since it's science fiction, you could think, well, they probably could build crazy things because by then the engineers would figure out ways to make it not be like unstable or earthquake safe and all this other stuff. So I would think we should be getting like, you know, a skyscraper that goes up like normal, and then all of a sudden in the middle there's like a giant sphere and then two skyscrapers jump out at like 45 degree angles or something. It's like, throw us something crazy looking, like we could think something that still looks built, you know, like buildable or feasible. But yeah, you would think that they would at least try something interesting, or, you know, spherical build on top of a skyscraper, or link skyscrapers with, you know, I don't know. It just seems like, but for San Francisco, and I remember there was one episode that one might have been now that I think about it, it was probably a holodeck. But I remember at one point they showed the Eiffel Tower because Picard was like looking at Paris. But I think that was,
like he does,
a holodeck thing. But even with San Francisco, I could see some cities where they want to maintain, like for historical value, like they would want to not over, and even maybe like New Orleans, when we see, you know, the Joseph Sisko, we don't see much of the city, but I can imagine, like, you know, there, maybe the, you know, Seattle with the Space Needle, like some cities I could see them trying to preserve, but there should be other areas and other, you know, cities in all across the earth at that point that just have crazy architecture.
Yeah.
But we just don't see it.
I mean, like in the chat, Stony suggested looking at the World Trade Center in Bahrain, I think is how you pronounce the name of that city. And I'm looking at it, and it's like, again, it's not your traditional looking skyscraper. It's like two kind of slanted buildings coming together with bridges between them. It's interesting because, like, you would imagine that as architectural and engineering restrictions become looser because your technology improves, you'd be able to have crazier and crazier looking buildings. So, like, I would imagine, like, maybe stuff that looks more like, you know, the Eiffel Tower or the Space Needle, which aren't really built that way because that's the most practical way to build a building. They're built that way because someone thought they would look cool, right?
Well, I guess it's true. The future is only as creative as your production designer.
Well, there's that, right? But I mean, like, you know, like New York City, right, is built for practicality. Like, in New York, they built up because they didn't have room to build out. So, you know, with exceptions, certain New York buildings are definitely designed with aesthetics in mind. But for the most part, a lot of New York City skyscrapers are very, you know, they're very structurally built. They have, like, the square corners and are designed for stability because when they were being built, they were, like, huge engineering feats, right? Like, just the fact that we could make buildings that tall was like, what the heck? Who even thought we could do this? So, you know, they didn't have the ability to, you know, just put up, you know, like, I don't know, like, put a giant wind sail on one of them for some reason. Or, like, a giant, or like a big old pyramid at the top.
Because you can.
Yeah, but if you can do that, I mean, why not? Like, then the other thing I was thinking, maybe even in the opposite direction, run this past you guys, see how you feel about it. I feel like part of the reason we build skyscrapers might not necessarily be because we need to, but because we have developed the ability and we feel the need to, like, show our capacity. So is it possible that in the future, when that sort of thing is incredibly easy, I mean, in the future they can build giant space stations, maybe we would revert to a actually less advanced, like, method of building things, or a less physically impressive, because it's so easy to build giant buildings that we'd be kind of like, eh, we could, but what's the point? Does that sound even kind of plausible? That's never a good answer. When you ask someone if your idea is plausible, they go, eh, no.
Well, like you said, that by that time they would be people would be seeing starships and space stations. So it may not be like, if they build like that building in Bahrain or wherever, it may not be that the people go like, ooh, that's crazy. You know, the way some people look at it today would look at some of those buildings. But maybe it would be something for like a cultural significance, or, you know, just, you know, build it that way to be different. So it's like a recognizable building, like, you know, a company or a organization or whatever builds, you know, very triangular. And then another company or organization over here builds very, you know, curvy. Mm-hmm. And it wouldn't necessarily be to show off our technical prowess. It's just like identifiable to be signature and unique or something. And so, because, you know, a lot of times we look at the Space Needle or the Eiffel Tower or some like that Bahrain building, and then you look at, you know, a skyscraper that's just a rectangle standing straight up. That's not going to be like, you know, instantly recognizable. Like, oh, that's the Chrysler building, or what? I don't know whatever it is, but you know what I mean? Like, you could almost like silhouette the Eiffel Tower or some of these things, and you know instantly, oh, that's this thing. Maybe that's why they would build crazy in the future, of not so much like, look at what we did, but like, you know, just to be signature, stand out. Mm-hmm. But
to like make their own city's iconography.
Right. And especially in, you know, we're talking about, you know, San Francisco and all this, and Paris and what, but in other words, to broaden out the view, the Federation wouldn't just be on Earth. So right. Maybe like, you know, on other planets, it would be very crazy architecture to represent that culture's views about things. You know, if it's very, you know, linear, maybe there'll be like, you know, 45 degree angle buildings all going in different angles like Crystal. And then another planet's going to be very dome centric, you know, and that's not like to impress people about, you know, architectural magic of like, ooh, look how crazy we could build, but because it represents something. And I kind of look at that like, I'm thinking of like Star Trek and Star Wars, yeah. When we have seen interesting architecture, and obviously there's like the Klingons are very almost pagoda / triangle, but then Bajor looks a lot like Naboo, you know, very, yeah. You know, domes on top of things, but not everything is just just a dome, but like the tops of the buildings are rounded and, you know, signature like that. And then Coruscant, which is going to be, you know, the super tall skyscrapers that have weird shapes. So I think we probably will see more and more crazy buildings. It's just that in TNG, they hadn't really, you know, thought of it in that way yet.
Well, one thing that is a distinct difference between Star Trek and Star Wars as far as planetary design, as like far as, you know, architecture goes, is that Coruscant is the home of the mid-air collision. because there, you know, Coruscant has flying cars everywhere. Whereas in Star Trek, other than like official shuttles, we actually don't really see much evidence of vehicles in Star Trek. Now, granted, that's because there's like a difference between movie budget and television budgets, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, I've always wondered, that's another part of this, how do Federation citizens get around? Like, I would imagine there would be, like, transporter stations, like we have bus stops.
I imagine they'd actually have really good public transit.
Yeah, they probably would, I mean, with a society like the Federation. But would that public transport be in the form of, like, shuttles and buses, or would it be, you know, you just walk up to the public transporting terminal and are like, I want to go to my dad's house. Bzzz.
Probably more like buses, I'd imagine.
I could see it being a combination. I mean, I don't know which one would be the more heavily prevalent, but I could totally see there being, because we see that, you know, at Starfleet Academy or just Starfleet headquarters, every time they show it, whether it's, you know, the movie, the TNG type era on the TV show, or the motion picture when Kirk is arriving at Starfleet headquarters, even Starfleet Academy in Star Trek Online, you always see like the shuttles coming and going, like, you know, docking as if, you know, the train is coming in, or people are, you know, almost like the ferry boats that go from island to island, or, you know, from New York to Ellis Island, or from San Francisco Bay to the, you know, Alcatraz or whatever. Like, I'm sure there's shuttles that are like, you know, floating, flying boat, buses, basically. Mm-hmm. But then even when in Family, the TNG episode, the Enterprise is back at Earth. And when Sergei and Helena Roshenko come to the Enterprise, Chief O'Brien's in the transporter room, and he gets a message, you know, from somewhere down on Earth. They're saying, you know, transporter station ready to beam to aboard. And the person saying it had like a Russian sounding accent. It could have been some other, you know, nationality. But to me, I just remember thinking, oh, that kind of sounds Russian. And then here comes Sergei and Helena. And so they obviously, you know, arrived by a transporter. Mm-hmm. And then another thing I was going to, you know, thought of and was going to bring up during the whole economy thing was, in one episode, Sisko said that when he was in the Starfleet Academy, like within just a few days, he always was beaming home to, you know, back to New Orleans. And so he used up a whole month worth of transporter credits within a few days of always beaming back home.
Right.
So it's one thing to say that, okay, Starfleet Academy would definitely have transporter pads or rooms to go, you know, up and down from ships to the Academy, but they would have to have, well, not have to, I guess, site to site type of thing, but they would also have a transporter receiver station somewhere in New Orleans for Sisko to beam over to, right? So I could totally, and for longer distances.
Yeah.
You know, if you're going to go from, like, you know, China to Paris or something, maybe you would transport, or maybe it's the opposite. Maybe they're going to use transporters for shorter distances, and the really long travel, you go in a shuttle. You know, I could see it being either way, depending on energy usage or, you know, that type of thing. But
on a minor note, back to clothing, I just want to make it, if anyone, whoever works on a Star Trek show ever listens to this, I would recommend watching Defiance as an example of how to do alien fashions, because I like Defiance a lot.
Or Blade Runner is a good example of different styles of futurism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no doubt.
Fifth Element, that's a good one.
That's just a fun one.
Yeah, well, Fifth Element is just like a movie where they were like, we are going to be insane in this movie. Let's do it. And they did. Which is, certainly has an appeal while you're watching it.
Well, also, the costumes were done by Jean-Paul Gaultier, weren't they?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
And in the
other JPG.
In the chat room, we're getting people talking about, like, super high-tech clothes, like, you know, like clothes that can also serve as flashlights or as like health monitors, which is an interesting idea, which again is something that they didn't really show us a lot of in Star Trek. Their clothes still seem to be made mainly out of, like, you know, cottons and maybe synthetic fabrics. They weren't like, they didn't have smart clothes.
And that's basically what they're being called now, is smart clothes, like, you know, smartphone or smart clothes. And there's ones that will, like, you know, it's built in to just keep an eye on your heart respiration, your heart rhythm and respiration, like, you know, athletes would use those. There's other ones that kind of give off antibiotics and stuff. But then aside from, like, the super smart, you know, computerized electronic type clothing, I just saw it come over, like, either Twitter or Facebook, I forget. But, you know, we've had Scotch Guard for a while, right, where you spray it and it totally will just beat up. But even in the early days, if you, like, really dunked it underwater, it would be too much for the little Scotch Guard surface protection thing, and it would get soaked wet. There's this new thing now where it's like a 2 or 3 stage process where you totally, and it could not just be for clothing, but that was what it was being demonstrated on. And it was called, like, I forget the name of it, but it was basically a way that you could have a cardboard box or a t-shirt, whatever it is. You spray this stuff on it, let it, you know, do its thing. And then you could take a total paper bag or cardboard box and pour water into it. And it's not going to in any way be affected by the water. And so they're showing, you know, people putting it on their clothes and then pouring drinks on themselves and stuff. And that instantly made me think of, what about the time where that ensign spilled her coffee on Picard and he's like, oh, now I got to go change because he's soaked. Or, you know, when they threw the water balloon at Worf, it's like, how come by that time it's so far in the future that, you know, the water should have just, you know, been repelled and not damaged or, you know, got their uniform all wet. But they weren't thinking, you know, that wasn't thought of or invented at that time. So, you know, even as much as DS9 and Voyager, things have advanced beyond that.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that's always a little bit, and looks like we lost Grace. I'm going to try to get her back. It's always the question of, like, when you're making a TV show, how advanced do you want to make your technology, right? Like, it was suggested in the chat room that, like, you could have, that nowadays we're working on clothes that can harden if they're impacted. So it's like clothing that would also be armor. But if you showed that in a television show, it might be a little confusing. It's like, you know, a guy gets shot and then, like, the clothing did that, and then you'd have to stop and explain what just happened, or people would get confused. So I can understand some of the, you know, you want to keep things certain level of simplicity, otherwise, like, too much stuff might be happening. Hi, Grace, you back?
Yeah, I'm back.
Okay, very good. On the issue of, like, transportation, I think it would kind of come down to, like, how much energy does Earth have at its disposal? Because when they mentioned transporter credits, I took from that they have, that transporters probably take a lot of power, and they have a limited amount of energy production on Earth.
Yeah.
If only because they don't want to have warp reactors everywhere.
That'd probably be a good idea.
You know, antimatter reactors scattered all over your planet. That's a pretty serious risk.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we see those things don't take that much to make them breach. And if it breaches on a ship, that's sad. We lost 500 people. But if one of those breached in the middle of a city, it would be like, all right, that's like 50 million people just dead. So probably you'd want to avoid that sort of thing. So I would imagine.
Well, it kind of in a way talks about that on, you know, we always go back to Memory Alpha. And on the page for transporter credit, it says that they were a rationed unit of exchange that allows for use of transporters on Earth. And then it says they were used at Starfleet Academy, and it's not known if they are used elsewhere. But then it says, being Starfleet Academy, which is basically kind of like a military academy, a military school, it would make sense that they're going to ration that to the students or to the cadets, because they want them there. You know, if you enlist in the military and you're at, like, you know, West Point or wherever, they're not going to let you go home every day. So it's like they're going to ration it. But then what about for civilians? You know, they're not going to be, well, you need to stay on campus and, you know, focus on your work type of thing. It made me think that I kind of like the idea that they came up with, and I know it was controversial and some people still don't like it, and there's definitely, you know, some issues with it that could be made better. But I like the idea of what they did in Star Trek Online with the energy credit. Because what we were saying before, it's like, let's say every Federation citizen, you know, not a Starfleet, not a Federation scientist, just, you know, Joseph Sisko with his restaurant type of thing. Mm-hmm. Everybody can get a replicator. Everyone, you know, would get, you know, blankets and clothing and a structure. You know, everybody would be, their basic essential needs would be taken care of. But then what if the people say, like Scotty, it's like when he said, well, that suits me, I just bought a boat. I don't think they're going to issue a boat to every person that, you know, the same way they would issue a replicator for their house.
I want 10 boats.
Right. So maybe it's like if we did incorporate the idea of the energy credit, similar to the transporter credit, maybe that would go back to, why would people work in the, like, the very menial or boring or, you know, dangerous or whatever jobs, is you would get more energy credits from that. And what the way I would think of that is, it's not so much money, but an allocation of a certain power amount of power, like the energy. And that's why if you had more energy credits, you could be beaming left and right because you're saying, you know, I'm allotted this much power or energy. I even kind of in a weird way think of it as oversimplifying it. But what if like one energy credit equals, you know, 5 AA batteries? And then, you know, if I got, you know, 10 energy credits, that's like, I'm not going to do the math, but you know what I mean? It's like you have basically allocated or able to use that much power, that much energy. That's how people would, you know, get bigger and better things or be able to beam back and forth or get, you know, your clothes, get, you know, a full room full of clothing that you don't really need, but you just want more clothing. So you would have to somehow acquire energy credits, and then you would take that to the replimat, you know, replicate all your stuff. I don't know. What do you guys think of that? Do you think that is
so well dressed?
Yeah, no, that's...
Would that still be a moneyless society, or would that basically be money, even though it's related to the energy to use the equipment?
I mean, that is definitely a form of currency. Now, it's a form of currency that would be very difficult to use outside of the Federation.
Exactly.
Like, you know, like when you're using dollars, you can generally, you know, if you go to another country, you can at least convert those dollars into the local currency. And a lot of the times, you know, other countries will take dollars anyway, especially if it's a country where the dollar is very, very valuable compared to the local currency.
Mm-hmm.
But it would be basically impossible to try to spend your Federation energy credits on, you know, on Ferenginar. And that is...
Right. Well, and that's why they showed in that one episode that Riker had a store or a supply of gold pressed latinum that he was dealing with Quark, you know, and Worf would have to have Darsex for when he goes back to the Klingon homeworld. But within the Federation, it would almost, you know, and it wouldn't be paper money. You probably wouldn't even need a credit card. It would just be like I don't know how they would apply it, but I kind of think that solves some issues, but then, you know, it could also create some issues, but it's interesting because I think it is kind of based on the idea of the transporter credit.
What was that, David?
It would just make sense that instead of, you know, this paper or coin or whatever representing gold, which is about like value,
mm-hmm.
that thing representing energy, because look at how everything is technological based and you have to power it up type of thing.
Yeah, that's and the idea of I've heard people sort of advance this idea before that in the future our currency will be measured in electricity, you know, like and that's an interesting concept. Although I do think that if it gets to the point of like where it is in Starfleet Online, that's clearly a currency. Like we can say we don't have currency, but we have currency. It's just energy credits.
There will be things considered valuable that we will trade goods and services for, regardless.
Right. I would imagine that when you're dealing with another, like, I would have to imagine that if a Federation citizen wants to go to another planet, right, that the Federation would have some kind of trade agreement with that planet, because we know the Federation trades, right? They don't, you know, they aren't an insular space nation. They would probably have some kind of agreement set up where a Federation citizen, by nature of being from the Federation, when they go to that planet, is allotted a certain amount of local currency to use. Because otherwise, travel in the Federation, out of the Federation, would be almost impossible. Like you would show up on, I don't know, Cardassia, just to name a random world, and have no money and have nothing that you could trade for money, and you just
gotta wonder what the exchange rate would be. Also,
yeah, like I would imagine that if you were gonna visit another country or another space planet, another planet that the Federation has a trade negotiation with or a treaty of some kind, they would have some kind of agreement over how much money you're assumed to have.
I'm still thinking of the space planet.
Space planet.
The space planet!
Well, even within the Federation, I mean, if we're talking about energy credits being used to, you know, get access to the transporter, you know, station, instead of a train station or an airport, you go to the transporter area and go, here's some energy credits, now beam me to the moon or whatever, right? Or, you know, replicate at the replimat, you want a guitar, you want, you know, this, you want that, so you're getting the stuff. But then that wouldn't really seem to be, because that is about powering up the replicator to get the thing out of the replicator, right?
Right.
That wouldn't seem, the energy credit would almost seem useless to Joseph Sisko's restaurant.
Right.
I mean, never in the episode does it say, like, you know, half off or any mention about having to pay for the food. It's the only time they mention a menu is Joseph Sisko saying, don't even look at the dessert menu because you want to get the bread pudding. It's just awesome. It never once mentions, like, prices on the menu or anything. So in theory, you could think they just walk up, say, I want a bowl of jambalaya, and they give it to them, you know. And since they're not using replicators, since everything's handmade, what would you use the energy credit for? You know what I mean? Unless right. to keep the lights on. I don't know. I could even within the Federation.
It's bridge running.
yeah, maybe, but.
You needed to power your stove. I mean, I would have to imagine that form of electricity would just be complementary. Like, the Federation would have to produce enough energy that powering a light bulb isn't going to be a big tax. So, I mean, it might be, it sounds like we're describing a partial currency, where there are certain things that, it's sort of like, you know, in the Federation, we've gotten to the point where there are certain things that you don't have to pay for. And it's kind of like that today, too, right? Even now, there are certain things that you don't have to pay for. It's sort of assumed that you have air, right? Fortunately, we haven't gotten to the point where people have to pay for the amount of air that they ingest.
Or sometimes water. You could, you know, sometimes walk up to a place and say, can I have a cup of water? And they just give you the water.
Right. So I would imagine in the Federation, what we would have is a partial... They say it's not currency, but it's like partial currency. Because again, you know, energy for transporters is still a limiting factor. Like, even the Federation doesn't have advanced enough technology where it can just produce infinite energy to power everything all the time, right? So if you want to use that really high energy stuff, then you maybe have a certain allotment, and if you want to earn more, you can go clean the sewers, which is reasonable. I would imagine the Federation might have a cap on that. Like, there's only so much you're allowed to have. Like, you probably, you know, I think that just by the somewhat socialist nature of the Federation, you probably wouldn't be able to acquire huge stockpiles of energy credits. Because then what if you decided to spend all of them at once and there's actually not enough energy to go around, right? Now I'm just talking weird economic theory.
Yeah,
I apologize.
Well, but I mean, it kind of does tie into, even when you said back to, like, what would you guys want to do if you're a civilian? And I said either, you know, be an artist or be, you know, like a Joseph Sisko with the restaurant, or just cook. And Grace said bartender. It's like, let's say, just to go along with that, let's say I'm a sculptor or a painter. So I paint this thing and I spend, you know, 10 hours doing it. And people are like, oh my God, that's the best painting ever I've seen or whatever. Or is somebody just going to walk up and pick it up and walk out? And I'm like, bye, you know, enjoy it. Or is there, you know, people are going to, you know, it kind of goes back to the whole commerce thing. Or like, are people going to buy it off of you? Do you just do your sculpture and then give it away for free? I mean, it kind of, money, even though it's not just about an economic discussion, that still ties into a lot of the questions about civilian life. I mean, it's just weird to think of people doing these jobs and services and activities and money and, you know, payment, mm-hmm. never coming into it. Now, some people brought up the barter. Maybe somebody would say, you know, take the painting and give me more paints so I could paint another one or something. Or, you know, I paint a thing, he's going to put it in his house, and so they bring me bread. You know, it's like, I'm a bread maker, and that's how you, you know, give your bread to other people, and they give you what they do. And it,
well, that was certainly how Jake and Nog were doing things in the cards. You remember that episode? But I have a hard time believing the Federation functions like that as a whole, just because that sort of system is very inefficient and very easily prone to, like, you know, it's like, man, I really need more paint, so I want to trade my painting for more paint, but nobody around me, the only people who have paint around me don't want my painting. So that's, so, you know, that's a whole, there's a reason that we invented,
style.
You know, there's a reason we invented currency as a species. It's because, you know, because currency basically exists to facilitate the transfer of goods and services, right? Like, that's why we made currency. And then, like, the whole stockpiling of currency is another issue altogether. So it's clearly this is a more complicated question than we can answer all at once. We're running out of time, but I would like to consider for maybe a couple of minutes is what do you guys think cultural mixing would look like in the Federation?
In what sense?
I mean, we very rarely see any aliens in background shots of Earth. And we hardly ever see, when we go to Vulcan, we hardly ever see humans living there. Do you think that different species in the Federations would move around a lot on their planets? Like, would we have a big immigration of humans moving to Andor because they like the cold?
I don't know. I think it would depend, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I don't know. It's an interesting topic, and we don't have enough time to answer the question. It's something I wanted to leave the audience with.
Just briefly, I think it would. I mean, in one way, why do most of the aliens look like humans with the rubber thing stuck to their face? It comes down to budget. You know, there was times in the movies we saw a, remember that when McCoy goes to that bar and he's talking to that alien with the big ears about going to Planet Genesis. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's times they try to show that there's aliens around, but I think it's just too much money to do that on a day-to-day episode thing.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, there'd be aliens on Earth, you know, mingling, and some humans would say, I just want to stay on Earth no matter what. And then other humans would be like, I want to see all the planets. You know, I think it would happen.
I'd want to travel.
I always like to think of the Federation, different planets, as being like different states within the United States, and being like, you know, I grew up in Honolulu, but I'm going to go to college in Seattle,
you know,
and it being no big deal, as opposed to like being a different country where it's like, I grew up in Honolulu and I want to go to college in Germany. It's like, that's kind of a big thing. But guys, this was an awesome topic. I'm really glad we decided to do this. Thank you to Christopher 13 for suggesting it.
Yeah. And thanks for showing up.
Yes. And
yep.
if you guys want to email All Things Trek, you can do that at allthingstrek@hotmail.com. But I think for now we are about out of time, and we'll wrap this show up. David, do you have some music for us?
Yep, we're going to go to a music break. Stay tuned, and we'll see what's coming up next.